Hi, good afternoon, and welcome to CSIS. Thank you all for coming out. I'm Steve Morrison with CSIS, with the Global Health Policy Center. This is part of our ongoing speaker series. Video and audio versions are on our website, and there are podcasts associated also on the iTunes University site from many of our speakers, including Ward Cates, who will be speaking here today. I want to offer special thanks to my colleagues for pulling this together, Suzanne Brundage, Emily Poster, Daniel Porter in particular, for pulling this together. I also want to make a couple of quick announcements before I introduce the subject and Ward Cates as our today's speaker. First of all, we've been joined on our staff by Lisa Carty, who has joined us now as the senior advisor and deputy at the center, and I wanted to make that announcement to you. We're really thrilled. Lisa brings just an extraordinary background as a career Foreign Service officer whose last day was last Friday or Monday of this week, I can't remember, but who brings an MPH background from Hopkins years as a refugee affairs official working in the Middle East and elsewhere, ran the UNAIDS program in Moscow, did a detail to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, a critical moment as it was beginning to establish its presence and amplify its programs here in Washington. So you'll be seeing a lot of Lisa in our programs as we move forward. We have a few other speakers coming up that I just want to remind you about. Michelle Kazakhshin, Executive Director of the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria, will be speaking here on Wednesday, February 18th. And that will start very promptly at 12:30 p.m. There'll be a light lunch served at that event. Please come. It's right here, same venue. On Tuesday, March 3rd, same place here at 9:30 a.m., Tuesday, March 3rd, we're going to do an event jointly with Chatham House in London. Chatham House has just begun its own program on global health. Chatham House is led by Robin Niblett, who was formerly for many years, for 20 years here at CSIS, and we're hoping to partner over the course of the coming years closely with Chatham House and with Robin, and this is really the first major event that we'll be doing. We'll be doing a launch of their global health program a week later in London. Nick Bonnet-Valla from the Ministry of Health, from the UK Ministry of Health, will present the UK Health Strategy, which is a significant unified strategy, aspires to taking a long-term strategic view, which is one of the issues that is front and center in our own work here in the United States. So please join us. That's Tuesday, March 3rd, 9:30. And then 2 weeks later, on Tuesday, the 17th of March at 2 p.m., Peter Small will come here from Seattle, from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. He's the senior officer and a leading authority on TB, particularly now on the XDR-MDR debate, and he'll be speaking on the subject of the global response and some of the other developments, particularly pertaining to China, that are coming forward. Now, today, we are thrilled that Ward has agreed to come and speak on this very important subject at this very important moment, looking at how to forge a new consensus and renewed interest and leadership in family planning and reproductive health against the backdrop of the many gains that have been made in U.S. leadership on global health in the last several years and the bipartisanship surrounding it. This is a terribly important subject. We know it's one that's innately divisive and complex, and we'll hear more about that. I mean, I was just when President Obama lifted the Mexico City policy at Friday evening of the first week that he was serving as president, it dawned on me that this issue of this back and forth around Mexico City has now gone on for 25 years, which it seemed like it was just a short while ago that started, but in fact it's 25 years running as a controversy that we struggle with. PEPFAR and those that support the PEPFAR programs have made a valiant effort to preserve a bipartisan and complex coalition moving forward. And we saw last summer during the reauthorization that there are key vulnerabilities around that. There are our own culture wars, our own controversies around abortion and related subjects that get in the way sometimes in a very grave, profound way of thinking concretely and finding the centrist common ground around very important issues centered in family planning and reproductive health. And I think this is one area where new thinking, new ideas, and a new ethic and spirit around this becomes very important in trying to create a long-term strategic approach that has the kind of stability and unity that we need and political basis that we need to overcome some of these things and do better. Ward Cates is known to all of the people in this room. He, since 1994, he has been the president, well, he currently serves as the president for research at Family Health International, a leading global entity in program implementation, in research, in creation of new partnerships. He is a doctor. He is an MPH from Yale. He spent 20 years in key leadership positions at CDC, serving in its abortion surveillance branch, where he was chief of the unit for 7 years, as the director of the Division of Sexually Transmitted Diseases, and as the director of Division of Training at CDC. He has published at a prodigious level over 450 scientific publications, including 170 original contributions, which he can count. Among those, also co-author of The Contraceptive Technology and co-editor of Sexually Transmitted Diseases. He's won multiple awards for his leadership and his commitments intellectually and in terms of just taking an issue and not letting it die, but keeping the focus on these. So with that, I'd like to introduce him, ask him to come forward. Please welcome him this afternoon. Thank you. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks so much, Steve, and it's really an honor to be asked to present this, and I usually don't get very nervous in front of a lot of audiences, but when I turned the corner and came into this room and saw so many of you who know even more about the subject than I do, it did create a wave of anxiety. Now, the purpose of this talk is really to lay the groundwork, not revamp all of global health, that's Steve's job, but to give specific program recommendation, or to give specific program recommendations, but rather to begin the work to reclaim lost territory that many of us have seen happen, and also push the U.S. role forward in the important area of family planning and reproductive health. Because so many of you know the field, some of these slides may be a little simplistic to you, but others will see them as at least an orientation, I hope. And I'm really welcoming the discussion afterwards so that we can have a lively start to this whole new U.S. global leadership, a renewal of U.S. global leadership. Now, it takes a village to do something like this, and many of the village are sitting in this room right now. Colleagues from FHI, USAID leadership, present and past. One of the past members, Margaret Neuser, was and is an author of something I'll show you in a minute, a helpful reference called Making the Case. People from PAI, the Population Action Coalition, the Guttmacher Institute, the Population Council, and many more. Those of you, many of you in the room. And here are some useful references that Margaret just gave me a hard copy of. The first one on the left, Making the Case, written by the five previous directors of the Population Office of USAID, the PAI background document, the Guttmacher Reviews. These are helpful references. And we are, as Steve said, in a new era. For, as the president said on that day he mentioned, January 23rd, for too long, international family planning assistance has been used as a political wedge issue, the subject of a back-and-forth debate that has served only to divide us. And we have to change that. It comes with high expectations. The leader of UN FPA said a few days later, "We are confident that under President Obama's direction, the United States will resume its leadership in promoting and protecting women's reproductive health and rights worldwide." The bar is high. So what am I going to talk about today? First of all, a little background into what might be some essential fundamental issues in family planning, just so we're all on the same playing field. Secondly, reasons for why has it been neglected in over the last decade or so. And it's not only polarization. The urgency for renewal. What are the family planning benefits? And finally, at least one suggestion of how we might get a start on renewing our U.S. leadership. Okay, what are the essentials? Well, let's start with semantics. What are we even talking about? We use the term reproductive health and family planning frequently interchangeably, and I am the worst on this. But reproductive health, if you begin with Cairo, with the International Conference on Population and Development in 1994, was expanded. It was a rights-based initiative to include a broader array of policies than fields than family planning, to include pregnancy, contraception, and sexually transmitted infection care, including cervical cancer care for the sexually transmitted infection HPV, human papillomavirus. So that is a broader terminology. Family planning is a component of reproductive health. It's the service of allowing couples to choose their fertility intentions, their plans for their families, and allowing them services to go in whichever direction they choose. And this is really involves a delicate balance between population-level thinking and individual-level thinking. At the population level, it involves what are the basic factors that do affect population growth. And at the individual level, it's what are those factors that affect contraceptive choice and then the effectiveness of that choice once it's been made. Let's delve down a little into that. The population directions are expanding. This is a very commonly shown slide projecting what is the world's numbers going to look like in 2050. And take-home message here is it will be up into almost double figures, probably double figures of billions of people, unless things change, with the developing countries or the less developed countries contributing the bulk of this growth. Let's see. Do you have a pointer, Steve?
No.
Okay. Well, anyone have a pointer with them? I should have. No. Okay, don't worry. Maybe I'll do. Let's see if. Okay, where is this growth happening? Now, this is a complicated slide. It's probably better I don't have a pointer because I'll be even better at guiding you through some of the X and Y axes type things. This is a slide that's describing the population trends, the projected population trends by region in 1950, 2000, and 2050. And the 2000 level has been set to 100. So it's a scale in the y-axis. And just read from left to right. You can actually see that the light blue bar, Carolina blue for those who come from Chapel Hill, is the 2000 level. And Europe actually will have a declining population in 2050. And you go through Asia, Latin America, North America, they will be increasing. But what are the two areas of the world that will have the greatest projected percentage population growth. By 2050, it's the Middle East and Sub-Saharan Africa. And think of the pressures that those population growth will have on areas that might be described as powder keg areas today. So I'll get back to that later on, but those are the regional trends. Now, when we look at the sources of population growth, and John Townsend, I was just with John Bohngatz on Monday, and we were going over this a little bit. If you stopped right today with the approximate level of population, it would be about 6.5, maybe a little higher, billion. We're talking in B these days in lots of areas. Some of that growth will be due by to 2050, growing up to a projected 11 billion or so. Some of that growth will be due to the population momentum of those who are already born and those who will reproduce and create their own momentum, the young reproductive age population. Some of that will be due to desired pregnancy with a high desired family size, which can be affected by lowering child mortality and by increased educational opportunities for women so that they will have opportunities other than in being mothers. But the part that is most affected by family planning is this unwanted fertility, the unintended fertility. The part of fertility that when you ask a woman, does she currently intend to get pregnant, and she says no, and she's not using a contraceptive, and she gets pregnant, gets categorized in our demographic surveys as unmet need. So the three components of population growth, one are the momentum, and that's already here. The second is desired family size that can be affected by other changes. And the third is unwanted fertility that can be affected by family planning. So that's at the population level. At the individual level, what are the contraceptives that are available? Well, many of you in the audience actually have visions of sugar plums or visions of these 16 approaches to contraception in your head every night as you dream. But and that's in the on the right-hand side. But these are now ordered according to their level of effectiveness from the less effective at the bottom to the most effective at the top. And the key factor that influences effectiveness are how dependent are these methods on user behaviors. And the more dependent they are on user behaviors, the less effective they are as contraceptives. So that those that are such as implants or IUDs or male or female sterilization, almost one-time decisions and then in place for a while, independent of a lot of user behaviors, are the most effective methods. Just for any of you who in the room who aren't contraceptive NICs, just wanted to give you a snapshot of the range of individual choices of methods that they have. And these 16 approaches are actually many more methods. Each one of these has different numbers of pills, different types of injectables, and so on. So, but just to give you from the less effective to the most effective, adherence is the issue. Okay. Switching topics now. You've had the essentials. Let's go to why the neglect. Why are we necessitating building back? Well, I have three reasons. The first is the emergence, the true emergence of higher global health priorities. Second is polarized politics. And third is within the general public and the world a perceived success of family planning programs. All of those, in part, contribute to a cumulative neglect. There we go. Take HIV. Oh, thank you. That's great. HIV, many of us tend to look at it and say, boy, jealously, look at all the money HIV gets. Well, this is a success story. HIV is a global epidemic. The arguably global health epidemic of my lifetime. And it has been very successful in recent years in mobilizing resources because of its high priority position in global health. And we see that family planning, on the other hand, has been unsuccessful in mobilizing resources. And if you adjust for the inflation, those are absolute numbers, inflation would make those numbers look even worse. So there are higher priorities, and there are successful higher priorities than family planning. Second is what we tend to drift into, but it's not the only reason. There's evidence of the Mexico City policy that Steve talked about, the revisionist terminology, reproductive health being equated with abortion, NIH proposals being having terminology changed in order to be read, and so on. And then there are the funding limitations that I showed earlier. And all of that cumulatively combined to produce a real chilling effect on science and services that we're going to have to shake ourselves loose from and work to overcome in the future. And it's this chilling effect of polarized politics rather than a motivating or a stimulating effect of consensus or common ground politics. We want to achieve the latter with family planning. And then there's the perceived success. Back in 1960, pre-hormonal, 11% of married couples worldwide were using, quote-unquote, modern methods of contraception. By 2003, worldwide, almost two-thirds were using modern methods. This creates a situation where most people are thinking, wow, family planning is widespread, family planning is available, family planning works. We're lowering families like Europe. But in actuality, let's just take the six highly populous countries in Africa, look at their contraceptive prevalence, which ranges, apart from Kenya, which is on the high end, still less than 25% modern contraceptive prevalence in those countries, and continued a high total fertility rate. Those are births, calculated births over the lifetime of the woman, a high total fertility rate, more than double replacement births in those countries. So there's the perceived success versus the actual contraceptive level and the impact on total fertility. And you put this into the perspective of the growing need. Here is just the growing numbers of reproductive age women in sub-Saharan Africa, from 206 million in 2010 up to over 400 million on 2040. And you then put that over the funding level that you saw, that I showed you earlier, and what we have in terms of, on the y-axis, dollars per woman of reproductive age, family planning dollars per reproductive age, you have a halving of those dollars from over 15 cents per woman down to 7.5 cents per woman the current times. Plus, you see the sort of sine wave that goes on from the on-again, off-again funding of this project. So you have a lowering level of family planning funds per reproductive age women, together with a variation that creates levels of uncertainty that makes it hard to plan. This all comes together and creates a definite level of what I talked about earlier, the unmet need. First of all, is the met need, both in terms of modern contraceptive prevalence in blue and traditional contraceptives in red, still less than 30% in all countries than Zambia. But when you superimpose the unmet need from the demographic and health surveys, as calculated, as I said before, do you currently intend to get pregnant? If no, are you using contraception? No. But if you're not pregnant or sterilized at that point, that is a level of unmet need within these surveys. Look at how high those are in many of these representative eight countries. The unmet need is higher than the total contraceptive prevalence in those countries. This is what the neglect has produced. So, how do we actually make the case for the urgency of renewal? It's the benefits of family planning in meeting that unmet need, in preventing the unintended pregnancies, that then will have a cascading level of public health, global health impact. What are they? An improvement of maternal and infant health, a reduction of the need for abortion, a preventing of HIV, an enhancing of and prolonging of education, a reduction of hunger, and a stabilization of society. Let's see how those. Let's see how the evidence actually supports that. If you prevent the unintended pregnancies, you're going to prevent the risks of those pregnancies of complications and death. If you are a woman in the United States, as most in this room are, on average, there's a contraception, 3 out of 4 are using modern contraception, and if you get pregnant, the health facilities are such that the probability of your dying from a pregnancy-related disorder in your lifetime is 1 in 2,500. As you go through the higher to lower level economic and contraceptive prevalence in Africa, from 55% in South Africa down to 26% modern contraceptive prevalence in Malawi, the lifetime probability of a woman dying as a result of a pregnancy disorder increases, pregnancy complication increases. And in Malawi, it calculates out to a 1 in 7 chance of a woman dying from pregnancy in her lifetime. By preventing unintended pregnancy is one way of reducing maternal mortality. It also, clearly, by reducing unintended pregnancy, reduces the need for abortion. And in Russia, after all of the Iron Curtain, as modern contraception was increasing, so was the use of abortion as a primary measure, as a primary method of family planning, which had been a hallmark of some of the Eastern European countries. And here is something that those of you who have ever heard me speak before have heard me talk about. I am incapable of going to any meeting and talking on any subject, whether it is football or knitting, without talking about the role of contraception on HIV prevention. And family planning reduces HIV. How does it do that? Well, most in this room understand that you can actually reduce perinatal HIV in 4 ways. You can prevent HIV infection in the woman in the first place. You can prevent an unintended pregnancy in a woman who becomes infected. For a pregnant infected woman, you can give antiretrovirals and reduce her risk of transmitting to her infant. And Pam Barnes was here several weeks ago talking about that particular phase of perinatal HIV prevention. And you can provide support to the woman and her family to prolong their lives and their health. Okay, what we're going to concentrate on, just for one slide, I promise I won't do any more, is what is the meaning of preventing unintended pregnancies versus using phase 3 antiretrovirals for prevention. Now, here is on the y-axis the number of infants or births in thousands is what we're talking about. Now, a very successful public health program has been the use of PEPFAR and Global Fund monies, Michelle's going to be here in a couple of weeks, and World Bank monies and others in order to test pregnant women and deliver antiretrovirals to those who are infected. And using PEPFAR data, over the last 3 years, 157,000 infants are estimated to have been spared HIV infection as a result of this true success story in public health. And we want to continue it and we want to expand it. 157,000 over the past 3 years of PEPFAR. Now let's see what contraception does. using demographic and health surveys, using the current levels of modern contraceptive use, low as they are, I showed you those figures earlier, low as they are in the PEPFAR countries, how many infants were spared HIV infection because unintended pregnancies were prevented by this effective contraception? Voila. Okay, let's do the math. 220,000 infants spared HIV infection by virtue of preventing unintended pregnancies per year, 660,000 over 3 years versus 157,000 with antiretrovirals. This does not, we have to scale up antiretrovirals even more. It is a success story. But we have to also, at the same time, rev up the making contraception available for those HIV-infected women who do not currently wish to get pregnant, meeting their unmet need. Enough? Okay. But you knew you were going to get it when I was behind this podium. Okay. The other issue is though unintended pregnancies also has an effect on the total number of births to families that are going to have health problems down the road unless we are even better at getting widespread treatment coverage. Family planning prolongs education. A few little factoids. First of all, at the school level, it's an obstacle because young girls getting pregnant drop out of school, and less than half of African women have completed primary education. And we talked about education being a key intervention for addressing at least high fertility desires. Secondly, population growth in and of itself. So the unintended pregnancy is sort of a double whammy. Leading to population growth puts additional pressure on a limited infrastructure. And here you see, far right-hand column, it's the percentage of youth up to age 18 who are either have children or are pregnant. And you can see the high levels, nearly half in Malawi and Bangladesh, over a third in Kenya, and almost a third in India. These are young women who already have children who are therefore tend to have education limited. It reduces hunger. Again, how is that? Well, there's lots of undernourished people, 850. That should be probably B. No, M? Okay, good. No, M. I'm sorry. No, it's only 11B. That would really be bad. That was a stimulus package. That's what I was thinking, right. Okay. But one-third of these are in Africa, where the unmet need, as I've shown you, is the greatest. And lastly, in order to meet Millennium Development Goal number one, which is to help eradicate poverty and hunger, reducing unintended pregnancy and demands on limited food is going to at least have a measurable effect. Not a panacea. None of the outcomes of family planning are going to be a panacea for our global health goals, but they certainly are a cross-cutting issue, a necessary but not sufficient stimulant. Stabilizes societies in some ways. The 9/11 Commission talked about high birth rates, producing a large, steadily increasing population of young men without any reasonable expectation of suitable or steady employment, which is a sure prescription for social turbulence. Do you remember that? Those areas of the world where there's going to be the most rapid population growth and perhaps the most susceptible. Just let's look also at what is the proportion of youth that are aged under 25. 0 to 14 in orange, 15 to 24 in blue. In Africa, almost 70%, over two-thirds of their population is in fact younger than 25, and you can think of the bulge, the population bulge, as that population will age and its pressure on societies. Having given you the background, having made the case for the urgency of a need for a family planning program, how do we actually get there? And let's just consider this a start. And our discussion, hopefully, will move us along. And rather than, really, you know, my view is rather than sort of getting jealous at PEPFAR, let's learn from PEPFAR. Let's take a cue from what is arguably the most successful public health program of our generation. It had leadership capitals, all of that. It's called PEPFAR for a reason. The first P of PEPFAR stands for presidents. Okay, that gives you an idea of what level of leadership we're going to want. There was broad political support in the PEPFAR authorization Steve was talking about last summer. It was incredibly bipartisan. Some holdouts, but mostly bipartisan. Resources, resources, resources. That is a common denominator. But they're not just financial. We're talking about human resources, and we're talking about building an infrastructure. Drugs and treatment was both a great strength and, in my view, a little bit of a weakness of PEPFAR, but the availability of antiretrovirals for people who needed it and the delivery systems developed as a result of getting those drugs to people who need it and need to stay on the drugs in order to avoid resistance and failure and so on is something that needs to be built on in the contraceptive world. And then there were certainly rigid targets set up. I euphemistically called it focused evaluation. But at the same time, what gets measured gets done. And PEPFAR got done because it was measured. So what does this mean for family planning? What can we go? Well, let's get an advocate from the highest level. Let's call it PEPFIP, okay? And let's get President Obama passing the FPPRIP program. Tough to say. Right, we're going to have to work on maybe another. And let him raise public awareness about this. Let him not go a day without mentioning the role of family planning in preventing unintended pregnancy. Let's have it always on the global health table. Let's never ignore it. We're into a presidential inclusivity of allies. Let's make family planning an inclusive field. It worked for PEPFAR. We have to move ourselves in that direction. And that requires broad political support, which to both encourage the political leaders, congressional staff. Any congressional staff here? Are you willing to vote? Yay, yay, thank you. Okay. You're going to get another target. At any rate, we need very broad political support. We need to achieve a consensus, a growing common ground on the benefits of family planning that you all have now down in your elevator speeches. It has to be evidence-based. We've had enough of non-evidence-based. It has to be bipartisan common ground by definition. And to protect us from the political polarization that leads to uncertainties and swings and on again, off again policies. The resources on a financial area, we are going to have to just increase our thinking by a whole quantum. The global asks by many of these reports are anywhere from 1.2 to 1.5 billion annually. And then to leverage the other donors who are coming into this field, the non-US governments, as well as the so-called key foundations that have their own reproductive health strategies, some pressures on them economically as well, but need to work in concert. The human resources to expand the technical capacity, and Secretary Clinton has already promised to do this at the U.S. AID technical capacity to be able to oversee this growth of family planning projects. And then in the field, so to speak, to expand our national and local family planning programs, whether it's in the government or ministries of health, with bolstering the staff task shifting and training of providers in order to achieve, sort of optimize the level of client care. And then at the client, create demands through education, through increasing supplies, through knowing what choices are available to them, and then making those choices real. And what about the infrastructure? HIV actually provides a fascinating lesson on how investments in care can actually grow rather than take from other areas. And I was working talking with Steve and Janet about the whole progress, slow but measurable, in the integration of family planning and HIV services as, in some ways, a first step to the health system strengthening, which has become so popular as sort of a goal to achieve the MDGs. And that means assimilate not just family planning and HIV together, but other programs with at least the resources available through HIV initially, but through family planning after we get all renewed, in order to strengthen the entire health system. And can this be done? Absolutely. Let's just take what happened in Rwanda. Here was the former hospital wards with sort of stained walls, stained floors, laundry hanging up in the hospital wards, and the laboratories on the right showing sort of very rudimentary equipment, microscopes at best, and really sort of facing the outside world. But what happens after HIV investments? Here are the much cleaner, much more welcoming hospital wards to empower clients, have clients feel their needs are being met. And in laboratories, a degree of sophistication that has also grown a quantum. And we've shown in Rwanda that before and after these pictures that I'm showing you today, actually the measurable services in family planning, in antenatal care, in immunization increased as a result of this investment in the infrastructure initially through HIV funds. So it is possible to leverage this success story, and that's what we're after. And then resources for commodities. Remember we talked about the antiretrovirals getting out? So we have to have the contraceptives getting out. In order to have multiple methods and give true choice, in order to have access toward the newest technologies, and then have those available at the lowest cost. A project that we're involved with, the Sinoplant project, which is a low-cost implant, is just one example. We need to guarantee for the manufacturers volume purchases so they'll make a commitment to actually rev up. We need to protect them from suits and give them liability protection as they're making these investments. And then for the nations themselves to provide subsidies so they can get their products and hopefully quality products more cheaply and locally. And then there's the research wing, the evaluation. We have to look at new and creative approaches for family planning delivery strategies, whether it be my colleague John Stanback has done with community-based distribution of Depo Provera. What are other ways of getting contraception out, whether it's actually promoting behaviors and promoting methods that allow for a better continuation of contraceptive methods. And then we have to develop new contraceptives. John Townsend was with us a few weeks ago. He made a phrase that I should have realized, but I hadn't realized until he pointed it out. He said, today's young women, and young women actually now decades into the future, are really part of the only system that's using technology that was developed 50 years ago, which really they're hormonal methods with different permutations and combinations, and plus some others. And the IUDs were available, the barrier methods were available. Where are the genomics? Where are the other things that might be allowing these better methods and better choices? So we have to expand choice. We have to expand choice to make them easier to use. Remember that it was the user independence that we were aiming for. Lower cost, always a key issue in today's limited resources. And then how about with some non-contraceptive benefits where you're, in fact, one thing I really loved about one of the campaigns that I'd heard was someone was talking about how to sell young women on contraceptives. And would you take a pill that would reduce your menstrual pain, reduce your menstrual periods, prevent acne? But there's one problem. You can't get pregnant. I'm thinking about that as a marketing tool. Okay, guys, that was supposed to be a joke. But all right. So it's one way of sort of talking about the non-contraceptive benefits. Another non-contraceptive benefit that we're just looking at for the development of microbicides now, and especially if we could find a microbicide that was also a good spermicide, is the lubricating factor that goes along with it. We were surprised in the midst of our trials that when those trials came to an end, the participants did not want to give back their products. They said it made sex more enjoyable, it made it better. And we're thinking, man, if we could ever find a microbicide that worked, let's market it as this pleasuring device. And oh, by the way, it also prevents STIs and HIV and hopefully pregnancy. But boy, buy it for pleasure. Now that would sell. Okay, this is the way we need to think of our field. And then what are other potential PEPFAR lessons? Well, Noel McIntosh has a very creative paper a couple of years ago where he talked about creating a global alliance for contraceptives and family planning, an alliance akin to the HIV vaccine enterprise that has really stimulated research in this area. He calls it GLOCON. I love that term, GLOCON. Okay, how about celebrity voices? Boy, they're all over. Where's our Bono? I mean, we want the family planning Bono. Okay. Public-private partnerships. Everybody says that. What do we mean by it? Well, in HIV, you have you have the investments in Uganda. You have investments in Botswana by Merck. And we need Organon. We need all of the large contraceptive manufacturers to set up their pilot programs for contraception in these areas and work with public agencies. And then the community voice. There is nothing stronger in the HIV agenda than the power of the community to speak out, to continually put pressure on all of us to move in toward prevention and toward treatment. How about mobilizing our communities to speak for women's choice, increased women's methods, and increased access and availability? So where do we stand with this? Well, we stand, hopefully, as a start to a whole new renewal. We want to make sure that we invest with resources in human, financial, infrastructure. We need to deliver the services to those who need them. We need to nurture providers, clients, relationships toward a common ground approach, and we need to evaluate. This has to be evaluated for quality, evaluated for effectiveness, and evaluated for impact, and to learn from that. Well, this is our start, and let's get going on your suggestions for how we continue it. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Ward. We're going to move into some comments and questions. I'm going to put just two issues out very briefly, and then I'd like to invite you all. What we'll do, Ward, is take several different comments and questions and then come back to you, and then we'll do another cycle. The first issue is, how does this all relate to the looming economic crisis? How does this all relate to the inevitable turn inward in the midst of our economic crisis, the delays that we're going to see in terms of health reform internally within the United States because of events this week and earlier in terms of leadership on HHS and elsewhere. I mean, it's a very, very crowded and fraught kind of agenda that we face today, and we're in a somewhat unprecedented era in the nature of the crisis. And so if you could speak to that a bit. On a more positive note is, I mean, it may be that this economic crisis creates opportunities we hadn't seen. I didn't mean this entirely as a negative piece. The other is, where in the world do you see the possibility for quick wins on something like this? And that requires leadership in the countries in which you're identifying the greatest unmet need and the greatest future projected unmet need. So where would you look when you survey the environment in Africa and elsewhere? Where do you think you'd see greatest potential for early big wins? If you could hold for just one moment, let's take two or three comments and questions. Please identify yourselves. Yes, there, we'll bring you a microphone.
Ward, John Townsend, Pop Council. Ward, this is a terrific presentation. One thing that I think that you could add to this is actually, what's the role of the private sector? If we had replaced family planning with soap or antibiotics or other things that we know that prevent infections and death and so on, at some point we have to figure out, how do you create markets to allow people to purchase, to stimulate innovation over time, and actually purchase these things as a regular part of their household budgets? We know when the economic banking crisis hit Indonesia, people reduced or changed their dietary habits. They used public transportation more than private transportation, but they didn't change their contraceptive use. I think once people start, I think they're willing to use, they see the benefits and they're willing to use it. If we only took a public sector perspective on this, the amount of money would be very high, and we might as well get family planning along with soap as a basic household purchase.
Thank you very much. Right here, Sam. Then we have a gentleman there, and then we'll come back to Ward.
Samuel Adeni Jones, HHS. One of the obvious ways to get money to kickstart the program would be the integration of reproductive health and PEPFAR and HIV/AIDS in general. There has always been some resistance. I remember in the 80s, at the beginning of the AIDS epidemic, when there was no money in HIV, there was resistance. There was money in family planning. There was resistance then in integration. Over the years, there have been attempts to integrate them. You've worked actually with both organizations. What do you think are the elements that we have to overcome in order to make that work?
Thank you. Sir? Next cycle will be all female, I promise.
It's just to ask why in the benefit, because understanding that there's a lot of resistance, even when family planning had money, you do not mention the economical benefit. Because I believe that for some decision makers, until we start to highlighting the economical benefit of family planning, they will not be engaged. I just wanted to know why on the list of benefit you mentioned, you skip the economical benefit.
I really wanted to answer right then, because that was a great question that really answered Steve's question about how does this relate as an opportunity within the economic crisis. Because you're so right. There is a cost effectiveness of using contraception to prevent unintended pregnancy on the costs of pregnancy and child rearing down the road. That cost benefit is greater in those societies where the costs of pregnancy and delivery are higher, such as the developed countries, than it is in the developing countries. But there still are cost savings for individuals, communities, nations that invest in family planning as a way of preventing unintended pregnancy. And the argument, therefore, is pay me now in order to avoid paying me later. Is that an easy sell? No. There one hypothesis on why we're in the economic situation we're in now is that people want to spend now and don't worry about collecting later. e.g. demands, this is probably for further tax cuts, not as a stimulus, but as a way of lowering it and being able to spend now. Okay. Steve asked, for what are the quick wins in those areas with the highest unmet need? The quickest wins are to make available permanent and long-acting methods, whether they be the current range of ideally implants or clinicians trained to insert IUDs or community-based distribution of the longer-acting methods in those areas of the highest unmet need. There are examples of where there is uptake, and by definition, with that uptake of these long-acting methods, you are having an immediate impact on longer-term prevention of the unintended pregnancies. That's where I would try at first to invest funds in those in where we have identified unmet need. I welcome what others would say as what where they would see the quick wins. John was asking, how do we make family planning like soap? He said we tried that with nonoxinil 9. I'm teasing because it's actually a mechanism of a detergent mechanism as to how it actually works as a spermicide by disrupting membranes. But how do we market family planning in a way that it becomes a commodity of choice when resources get low that you're going to spend first on family planning? By the way, this is not only a problem with family planning. This is a problem with prevention overall versus treatment. Whether you're talking about at the individual level or at the population level. We're always willing to put money into things in general after they become so bad that we need to cure them or get them better. We're less willing to put it into keeping healthy people healthy. But there have been ways of stimulating the purchase of prevention activities. Condoms being one thing, would it be the pressure of HIV as a stimulus? Probably in those high HIV areas. But boy, I'd be interested in other ideas that people from PSI or others here, if they're here, might have on how you create that social marketing. And finally, Samuel was talking about the inevitable resistance, which he found initially within the family planning community to involving HIV, which was in the early days quite profound, being a person who had migrated in those early days from the family planning arena into the sexually transmitted infection HIV arena. And it was very interesting to see that my family planning colleagues were very slow to pick up what was going to be a global health challenge in sexual health, their domain. Having said that, isn't it interesting how the pendulum swings and all of a sudden HIV has money and then they're very reluctant to adopt family planning? The bottom line is we are in the field of sexual health, whether it be at the level of the individual making choices, her or his choices about his or her sexuality, his or her approaches to sexual wellness, or whether it be a country making their choices about these. These are natural bedfellows rather than strange bedfellows, pardon the term. And we do have to gain consensus within the field and, as I suggested, take our cues from the successes in HIV.
Great, thank you. We have two hands here and two hands there, and then we'll come over to Ray next.
Hi, Katie Porter with Population Action International. Thank you for recognizing our work, and thank you for a really excellent presentation. I'm wishing that you had spoken earlier during PEPFAR reauthorization, because I think you're very convincing, and I think you really helped to illustrate why it is we talk about integration. I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about the slide you put up that shows the disparity in funding between HIV/AIDS and family planning, and how not only does that affect family planning programs, but how does it affect the AIDS programs on the ground? We have competing priorities. Members of Congress need to decide where to put limited resources. And so to the extent that you can sort of talk a little bit about what funding disparities in this example means for both programs would be helpful. Thanks.
Thank you. Over here. Catherine.
Hi, this is Lindsay Bonanno. I'm with Elizabeth Glazer, Pediatric AIDS Foundation. I also want to echo the sentiments and what a fantastic presentation this was. When you were discussing human resources and expanding national and local family planning programs, I was hoping you could elaborate a bit more perhaps on addressing stigma and how you, any suggestions you have for that.
Thank you. We have two hands. Ann Peterson.
Thank you. Hi, Ann Peterson. Great presentation, Ward. Love that. I have actually one comment and three questions, I think. I was surprised that two of the benefits that I expected you to talk about, you didn't. One was birth spacing for women who want children, but not right now, and just how much benefit that can have on maternal child and infant mortality. That pulls in a whole population of partners for you that you might miss otherwise, especially if you think about the teens that you talked about a little bit later relative to HIV. We've talked a little bit about HIV and PMCT. One of the issues that I struggled with, I know Margaret struggled with a lot, and that is you've got an HIV-positive woman during pregnancy, you've given nevirapine, and then in the past, we sent her home, sometimes with counseling on family planning. And I frankly think that's unconscionable, so we need the family planning in that setting. As you said, it would prevent pregnancy, but it would also mean that our limited family planning dollars would get wrapped around HIV programs, which in fact might change our geographic distribution of family planning. How are we going to balance that, you know, ethical dilemma with a funding dilemma with people in non-HIV, you know, prevalent areas who need family planning? And the third is, the comment is, HIV, I think, got funding because it was new, it was crossing borders, and whether it's family planning or child survival, we haven't got that new message. As you pointed out, people think it's old. How are we going to get new? What's going to be the message that's going to get it on the radar screen in that element of new?
Thank you. We have two hands that were up in the back row there. Can we quickly get your comments? Questions?
Crystal Lander, Center for Development and Population Activities. I had three quick statements. The first one is on the consensus or coming to some sort of common ground. Something that was mentioned very briefly was the word abortion. And if we can't come to a common ground as a reproductive health, maternal health, newborn infant health community on that, how do we really integrate into other things? So that was my first one. The second one is, we did say reproductive health from the beginning. You gave the caveat that we kind of shortened language, say family planning. So I just wanted to make sure we were talking about reproductive health with some of the statements that have been made. And then the third thing is, in the domestic community that advocates for reproductive health, particularly in communities of color, there has been a lot of discussion about, we don't need a menu or a supermarket of contraceptives. What we need is contraceptives that are available and that are culturally sensitive. And with some of the research and testing that's gone on, they carry that stigma. So can you talk a little bit about those things?
Yeah, I'm Sunita Sharma from Futures Group International, and this is, it was an excellent presentation, and we really need evidence-based advocacy to mobilize political support and resources for family planning. And one of the effective interventions or strategy we have is actually demonstrating the impact of population growth on different sectors and helping countries achieve their economic growth goals or elevation of poverty. When we can show the impact of population growth on how much you can achieve economic growth on water sector or health sector and other sector, it can be a very powerful message. And also in the changing funding environment, I think it's important if we can somehow link family planning to development programs and agendas like countries have Vision 2030, Vision, those kinds of economic growth plans or MDGs or PRSPs for poverty alleviation, those strategies can be very effective in terms of linking or mobilizing resources for family planning.
Thank you. Thank you, Warren. Well, I'm going to let my colleague John Townsend address the that last one, which is family planning and development, who spent part of his life looking at those types of issues. Let's see. Let's go back, and I'm going to let my colleague Gordon address the slide of family planning. If I can, I don't know if can we turn it on again. I'll guide into you. I just wanted to give you guys a little bit of a heads up that this is going to be turned to you, because it's Gordon's slide of HIV versus family planning funding and what are some of the factors that that might be reasons for that. Anne had as one of her questions the hypothesis that HIV has done so well because it's the new kid on the block, and I think. It was really interesting. I was there when HIV was truly the new kid on the block, so new that it was called KSOI, as Phil remembers, not Kaposi sarcoma opportunistic infection, not HIV. It didn't achieve that nomenclature until the mid-1980s. And it got no funds at all for the first 4 years when it was a new kid on the block. It's become the new kid on the block globally, really only after in the new millennium in some ways, though certainly programs were growing in the meantime. But I think there are other reasons why I think it is a global health epidemic of our lifetime and was recognized as such as a humanitarian response from the Bush administration, which is something that great applause should be given. Let's see, and I'm just trying to address at least one per questioner and then turn it over to others. One of the issues is how, if we can't agree on abortion, are we ever going to get consensus on family planning? And I would flip that response. I would say we can get consensus on family planning and preventing the unintended pregnancy leading to abortion, even when we have deep personal and moral disagreements about abortion. So that's why I think I'm emphasizing the common ground around family planning. If we will really not be very successful, and Ray Martin might want to comment on this, about achieving common ground with those people who tend to equate family planning with abortion rather than preventing the need for abortion, or even worse, a time when reproductive health itself was defined. Reproductive health was defined as abortion, and we as representing the U.S. government could not use the terminology reproductive health. That is a division that I don't think any of us are going to win. It's just too deeply seated in personal values and ideology. But with family planning, we ought to be able to make the case. And the case of, again, the last question of the previous round of questions dealt with cost effectiveness. That's another case that we ought to be able to make more effectively to legislators in the time of economic crisis. Now, Gordon, would you like to talk about the Gordon slide is what I call it, so you better be able to. And John, maybe about the effect of family planning on development. Up here with the microphone? Probably figuring who's Gordon. Gordon's the guy with the red tie right up here in front. Gordon Raley.
Yeah, thanks, Ward. The slide itself is really just showing the appropriation numbers, of course, comparable, and I think everyone understands that. I think the question was, so what do we do about that divergence? And I think, at least in my opinion, the issue is, first of all, not to be competitive. We don't want to base the need for family planning as if we deserve a bigger share because they get more and we don't. I think that falls on deaf ears. So one answer, first of all, is to get more funding for family planning, and that's really the fact now that we're beginning to be able to say $1 billion without gasping and without worrying about the what they call the laugh factor. You know, when you go to Congress, we literally were having that debate less than a couple of months ago when people were recommending amounts for it, and lo and behold, a bipartisan group came out and talked about making – these were past heads of the Family Planning Reproductive Health Units, as I believe within USAID. Republicans and Democrats came out and said, you know, $1.5 billion wouldn't be bad. So it's looking at those kind of numbers based on what we need rather than someone's got more than we do. The other thing is that word wraparound, I believe, that someone mentioned. And it's wrapping both of those around each other. When we talk about integration, we don't just have to talk about integrating family planning into HIV programs. We also need to integrate HIV programs into family planning programs. There are a lot of places in the world where women, because of stigma, are much more readily to go to a family planning service than they would to an HIV clinic. And there are places when people go to HIV clinics that they desperately need family planning services. So that can work both ways, but the word wraparound when we talk about integration is probably key.
Thank you.
I'll quote John Bongartz, I guess. Population family planning doesn't resolve development problems. It just gives you some time to deal with the consequences of them. In some sense, John's been focusing his entire career on the consequences of rapid population growth. Last month, we had some discussions with some policymakers from Mali and Uganda, and the data that they showed to us was that by the end of those graphs that Ward showed us, Mali will be the size of France and Uganda will be the size of England. Thinking about the infrastructure and what that means for the quality of life of inhabitants is frightening. An investment of $1 in California, Phil Darney just did a study, came up with a figure that the state of California saves $6. We did a study about 25 years ago in Mexico where you know, a peso invested in family planning saved 8 pesos to the state. In Kenya, where the state doesn't spend that much on it, there are still savings, but the question is who pays and who benefits? And furthermore, as in the case of Mali and Uganda, when does that benefit really occur? I think it comes fundamentally down to the question of do men and women really care about women's health? The importance of integrating maternal health in this discussion is critical. It isn't just infants who die, it's mothers who die. And I think thinking about the consequences of decisions for the future of youth in developing countries is frightening, and we have to keep policymakers' nose to the information that we have to care about the schools in Uganda, even if the president doesn't.
Let me make one comment there, because to Lindsay's question on stigma, which is a really good one, and Gordon touched on it in his answer, and that's that, in fact, some people prefer to go to family planning clinics or primary care centers in order to receive HIV care because they're not going to HIV clinics. On the other hand, and that's sort of the mainstreaming, what IPPF calls the mainstreaming of HIV into reproductive health care. Another aspect of stigma that is still being tested, but it's my personal belief that the hypothesis that the more people know their status, the more testing that we do, the more people are aware of their infection status, and the more they know others who are infected, and we've seen it in this country, the much less stigmatic the entire situation becomes. It's the uncertainty, both as an individual, the subconscious fear, and at the population level that we don't know how much is around. When you actually see people who get tested, who are living normal lives, who are getting treated, and it reduces, it tends to have reduced so much. Again, another comment on that might be from John or anyone else who've been part of the Horizons Project that did a lot of studies on this and ways to try and reduce it.
Thank you. This question around how easy will this be? One possible reaction, Ward, is to say, are you underestimating how difficult it might be? Mm-hmm. And I don't take that view personally, but I think that we need to put that out there as a serious issue. I mean, there's a lot of deep skepticism that this is an issue area that can be moved. There's a certain built-in set of habits about don't go there. It's a toxic. You can drift into a toxic zone, and you can break things that are working around. You know, we saw some of that logic in the PEPFAR reauthorization. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a consensus around some bigger goals. You move here, you could break a bigger set of things. There's the antagonisms and suspicions that are felt, this mutual sense of grievance that cuts across camps, the radicalization of voices, where you have some dominant voices that are very loud and can make that sensible center very difficult to be heard or drive people to hide in that. These are all factors that I think we need to talk about if we're going to have a realistic way forward. The other thing is I do think that within some of the communities there's been a reappraisal that's gone on and that there's new facts and new thinking. And I know Ray had an input, and I wanted to ask him to he had his hand up, and I wanted him to say something.
We'll come to you in just a second. My name's Ray Martin, and I'm director of a network of nearly 100 Christian organizations involved in health in developing countries that grew out of the Global Health Council about 20 years ago. And I'm also a retired USAID population officer. Just to give you that perspective. One thing that I think we have observed, Ward, I would like your thoughts on some ideas on a process toward seeking common ground. But one thing that was quite obvious in the last number of years is that one point of perceived resistance to an expanded U.S. engagement in family planning was coming from the religious community. And I think now that I'm involved in the religious community quite deeply, that view reflected a rather small segment of the Christian or the religious community, but it was a very loud and visible voice. And to see whether we could find some other perspectives from the faith community, we undertook a study with USAID funding and help from the Georgetown University Institute for Reproductive Health to see what our own members are doing and what their views are on family planning. And about 2/3 of our organizational members participated. I think it was 67. And interestingly, and we produced a report with funding, thank you, from Ward's organization, the Family Health International, that showed that none of the participating organizations opposed family planning. Slightly over half were actually engaged in family planning services or information. And a good share of the respondents were quite open to expanding their family planning activities if new resources became available. And this voice was very loud from our African members. And one of the things that I should mention that abortion was, in many of the discussions, a flashpoint. And we had to make very clear that our definition of family planning did not include abortion. We are exploring ways that we can work both within the faith community and in dialogue with other interested stakeholders on trying to identify some common ground that hopefully would lead to a greater conviction in the political world that it's safe to support increased investment in family planning. And so I would like, and CCIH would very much like to participate with any of you who are interested in that, in exploring how we might find acceptable language and acceptable definitions and so forth, so that we might move toward some kind of common ground consensus. I have a number of the reports. If any of you are particularly interested in exploring how to work with the faith community, I can give you a report. And I made a one-page summary. There's a stack of them on the table outside, and help yourself to them.
Thank you, Ray. We had a hand right here. And then we'll come back to you, Ward. We're getting towards the end of our hour, so I apologize for something. Yes, please.
I'll be brief. Jessica Berlin. I work for Senator Kennedy's foreign policy team. Somebody mentioned earlier with the question of how to make family planning new and how that could be brought again to the forefront of people's minds. And my initial thought was tying it in with climate change and environmental urbanization and energy sustainability. And I'm wondering what, if any, synthesis already exists with those sectors and the family planning community, and what, if any, moves have been made to increase that connection.
Let's get one last right here behind you.
I'm Dan Singer from the National Institute for Children's Health. I wasn't going to say anything, but Sam opened his mouth, so I think that makes it okay. My question is you raised PEPFAR as a model, and how would you respond to the critics who feel that PEPFAR is fundamentally an unsustainable model because it's dependent on the good graces of the United States to continue to supply resources and drugs to countries that themselves haven't shown much of their own investment in this? And if people really have data that show that you save money through investment in these programs, and yet those countries themselves aren't willing to make those investments, how do you make a moral argument that it's our responsibility?
Responding to Jessica's question about climate change is, where's from PAI? Right, there you are. I'm going to turn that to you guys because you have some of the position papers on this. And yes, it is a definite part of the growing sort of policy papers on roles and benefits of family planning, and there are analyses on that. Regarding Ray's question about processes of seeking common ground, you sort of answered it with your second comment, Ray. You surveyed people, you dispelled the myths of the loud extremes, you found out what the main thinking is. And that's really evidence-based common ground approaches, where the sensible and center, and the sensible majority center, because I'm, as an epidemiologist, sort of a bell-shaped curve guy, and that's that means that the bulk of the bell is in the center, but we tend to hear from the poles on either side of the bell. And that's what you hear because that's what the media love to quote. And so there's a perception that there's not support. So you have to continually demonstrate popular support for this. I agree. When we're building this common ground, it's around family planning, not abortion. Abortion is too much of a personal value. And that becomes flashpoints for the personal values. Is it going to be easy? And answer my last comment is Steve's question, have we underestimated the difficulty? If someone had asked me, because some people were saying, could we ever envision a program where USAID the U.S. government would infest B? This was back when B was really a meaningful term. In having the programs against global HIV, I thought I would have asked them, what were they smoking? Because it really was something that it was not getting a lot of traction within at least the worlds that those of us at CDC at the time were looking at. We thought it was big time to get several hundred into it, and very little internationally. But it has happened. Will it be easy? No. Is it possible? Absolutely. Can we do it? Yes. Can we create an agenda? We've already started. That's what today is about. That's what we're moving toward. Do we have a president that's sympathetic? Yes. Can we enlist him? Let's try. Don't let him go a day without having family planning on his table.
Ward, thank you very much for all the time and energy that you and your staff put into preparing this presentation and the goodwill and everything that you brought to the discussion. I mean, there's a lot of fundamental optimism, a lot of detail to the vision, and it's very timely. And so thank you very much.